Radio.
And good evening, everybody, and thank you for choosing King Jordan Radio for this November 27th, Tuesday, 2012. I am your host, King Jordan, coming at you. Back to back, we have two awesome all-star legal defense attorneys. Yesterday, of course, we had Joey Jackson. Today, we are expecting to have Richard Herman, who you see on the Nancy Grace Show. And, of course, at 8:20, we're going to have the Mighty Quinn. We'll get into some NFL picks. We'll get into the Knicks-Nets, what happened yesterday with that. Possibility that Josh Hamilton could be a Yankee. That much, much more. But in terms of Richard, we're going to get into the newly found evidence of Google searches, what this means to the case, the Anthony case, and much, much more. So as we await Richard, let me tell you that if you are in the New York area and you're looking for a good car service, there's no better car service to go than Prestige. Prestige is your ticket. They're at 718-336-5200. If you mention King Jordan Radio, you just might get a dollar off. Also, I like to mention, I was plugging the Royal Pizza, but they're not around right now. They got shaken by the Hurricane Sandy. They'll be back in the summer. A lot of places got shaken here. Let me give some props to Brighton 15th Street store. Ahmed, they came through in the clutch. Let me give them a live shout-out. When I needed them something like charge, for example, they helped me. And I think we have Richard Herman on, legal analyst for CNN. Richard Herman, are you there?
Is this the king?
This is the king.
How did you get that name, brother? How did you get to be called King Jordan?
Well, let me tell you, it goes back to 1996 when I was a teenager, and I was involved with wrestling. And a photographer by the name of Blackjack Brown decided that I would be King Jordan. So,
like Jerry Lawler, right? The king.
Right, exactly. Like Jerry Lawler. So, you know, my name's in the New York Daily News today. That's King Jordan, as it's been for the last 10 years. So that's how it became King.
All right, and before we get started, Knicks or Nets?
You know, I got to ask you also about that. I was born and raised in Brooklyn, right? But
right.
I grew up watching the Knicks. Now, there's a certain code, if you're a sports fan, that you can't change the teams like the Mets fans when the Yankees are good, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
So I'm a little confused on this one. Am I allowed under the Mike Francesa law to change teams? Or can I just, you know what I mean?
I think it's binding. It's Giants and Yankees, Jets and Nets, Yankees, Giants and Knicks. I think that's just how it goes. You can't change.
Are you allowed to say Jets anymore?
I can't. And I wouldn't want to. It's just horrendous. Devastation, what's going on with the Jets.
No. Are you in favor of putting Tebow in or changing coaches? What's your opinion with that before we get to the legal issues?
I think they should get rid of Tebow and the coach.
There you go. Okay, Richard Herman, we have a lot of cases to get into. I believe a lot of people are telling me you were the first person to break the whole story with Colorado in the James Holmes case, right?
Yeah, we began with that at CNN, and we broke it, did fairly extensive coverage on that. Just a devastation, tragedy, incomprehensible. You know, you just can't even appreciate the magnitude of it. Imagine sitting in a movie theater and some lunatic opening fire with automatic weapons. I mean, it's just, it's incredible. It's beyond incredible.
Exactly. Did he have an escape plan?
that's the thing with this guy. You know, you want to try to go with an insanity defense or some sort of diminished capacity, but so much time and effort and planning went into this that, you know, it's going to be very difficult for this guy. And they're going to bring experts in, and the defense experts are going to say he didn't appreciate the nature of what he was doing at the time, and the prosecution experts are going to say he did that careful planning, he knew this was an intended act by him. You know, the jury will make the ultimate decision. And sometimes in cases like this where the crimes are so horrific, that the jurors, they don't care what the jury instructions are. And I heard Joey yesterday very eloquently describe for you how the judge charges the jury for jury deliberations. They don't care. They just want to get someone's butt, and they want someone to pay for it. And in this particular case, with the press of this guy looking like a complete freak job on every picture they take of him, painted himself red, all these people that were killed and injured and maimed, you know, it's a very difficult case to win as a defense attorney.
And as a defense attorney, would you go near this case?
Well, you know, I might go near it to save, let this guy try to see the light of day again. But, you know, that's the thing. When you're early on and practicing, you don't have the luxury to turn down cases or walk away as you get a little older. Now, I've been practicing over 30 years, and I've been very fortunate. I'm at the point where I can reject a case that I may not want, that I don't feel in my heart. You know, if I don't feel it in my heart and I get up in front of a jury and, you know, I bring passion and I flamethrow and I bring it hard during a trial, the jury's going to see that my heart's not in it. And if my heart's not in it, they're going to think I don't believe in my client. And if I don't believe in him, why should they? Him or her, I should say. So, you know, it's a tough thing, and I'm not court-appointed counsel, and those court-appointed defense attorneys, either working CJA or a public defender, I mean, these are some of the true heroes in the legal system, because they get hit with cases that, I mean, I could never go near in a million years, and yet they do it, and they do it to the best of their ability to try to ensure the Constitution is adhered to, and, you know, I tip my hat to them.
I asked this of Joey Jackson yesterday, of you. How did you get started of this? What was your fallback plan? And what was your most successful acquittal?
Okay, well, Joey, by the way, is an absolute sweetheart. And he and I have done some shows together. And, you know, I enjoy him. He's very eloquent and a great attorney. I was glad to see you got him on.
Yeah.
If law was the backup, football was the number one plan.
Oh,
football
really?
Was all I really cared about. I went to school in New York at White Plains High School, and I played quarterback up there for many years, and we had outstanding teams. And one of my receivers, you may have heard of him, was Art Monk, who went on to Syracuse University and the Washington Redskins and a Super Bowl ring and a Hall of Fame. And I played with a kid who went to Dallas, walked on as a free agent for the Dallas Cowboys, became captain of the special teams, and then got a Super Bowl ring, Jay Saldy, also from White Plains. So
wow.
Another kid a year older than me, Tommy DePasso, went down to Penn State, started, filled in for Greg Buttle at inside linebacker for 2 years, went on to the Cincinnati Bengals, and injured his knee there. So I wanted to play football, and that's all I wanted to do at quarterback. And then, lo and behold, my senior year, I blew my knee out.
And you're Jewish. Would you be the first Jewish quarterback?
I think Sid Luckman may have that title, but not too many, that's for sure. But
no,
anyway, you know, I blew my knee out. I mean, MCL, complete blowout. I needed four operations on my knee done at Lenox Hill. James Nicholas, who operated on Joe Namath, did the surgery. And, you know, I came out of that, and the knee was needed time to rehabilitate. So all the big schools that were interested, Penn State, some of the other big ones, you know, took a pass on me because they weren't sure I was going to make it back. And I ended up choosing between Lehigh and Cornell because I said, listen, I need an education to fall back on and go to law school if I can't make it in football. But if I can make it in football, the pros will take a look at those schools, because if you remember, Cornell had Ed Marinaro, who played there, and Lehigh had a kid named Kim McQuilkin, who went to the Atlanta Falcons and played pro ball. So I figured if the knee cured itself and healed up nice, I'd get the look-see. If not, I'll go to law school. Well, that's a tough injury to have, especially in the mid-70s. They weren't doing arthroscopes then. They were doing train tracks. And
right.
As good as Nicholas was and is, and I revere him, it's a miracle what he did to my knee. It just didn't heal up the way I wanted it to. So we ended up winning the national championship at Lehigh my junior year, but that was it. I couldn't even walk. I mean, I was limping all over the place, and I decided that law school it's going to be, and that's what it's been.
What did you throw for? Do you remember?
Excuse me?
How many yards did you throw for?
I played so many years and on so many different and teams between high school was, White Plains is major football back in the 70s. Now it's a different program there, but, we had a passing offense my senior year because of my knee. So between Monk and the other receivers we had, we were averaging 250 to 300 a game in the air in high school ball. And, that was pretty amazing. And, It was just one of those things where football just, it was supposed to be, and I should have listened to my father and stuck with baseball, but I wanted to play football, and
yeah,
it didn't work out.
You're some of the people that are in baseball, and, you don't see as much injuries as you do football, and you see a lot of concussions, and, Junior Seau last year took his life, because a lot of people say because of a concussion that led to it. So.
Yeah. Well, growing up, it was Mickey Mantle or Joe Namath. So pick. And I picked Joe Namath. Should have gone the other way.
Now, your most famous case that you can look back, and you'll say to somebody, this is the most famous case. Not famous, but to you, that you're most proud of, that you did your most research for, and that you either got an acquittal or a lesser charge count.
Yeah, I have a handful of them, and every criminal defense attorney is going to tell you they have, a couple, two or three. But the biggest acquittal came in a case in the Middle District of Florida, the largest insurance fraud in the history of the United States, where a corrupt prosecutor down there decided that she wanted to be the new Marsha Clark and went around indicting anybody that even talked to any of the players, let alone wouldn't help her and get on the witness stand and lie and be a rat and make up stories. And lo and behold, this lunatic, this crazy, unethical federal U.S. attorney in the Middle District decided it was her time to indict me in this case because I wouldn't help her.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't help her. I wouldn't sit down and make up lies and plead guilty to crimes that I had nothing to do with. And I ended up going down to Orlando, believe it or not, and I tried the case. I represented myself in an 11-month federal trial in the Middle District of Florida, and 29 people were convicted and went to prison, and I was the only acquittal, which was nothing short of surviving a 747 crash. I mean, think about it, Middle District of Florida. I got every strike in the world against me. That's not Miami. That's not Fort Lauderdale.
Right.
That's the Middle District of Florida. That's, that's the South. So I got Park Avenue, Drew Attorney. Three strikes, you're out. I got them all, and I'm on trial for my life down in Orlando with this corrupt animal prosecutor who never even had the decency to apologize to me afterwards. But in any event, that was the biggest, no question about it.
Yeah, you were talking a little bit about Penn State, which leads me to the Jerry Sandusky case. First, I want you to comment on his lawyer, Joe Amendola, as I brought this up to Joey Jackson. Why did he put him on Bob Costas Live when he wasn't even prepared, and would you have done that?
These attorneys who get their, 30 seconds of fame don't know how to handle it, and they want to get their name in lights, and they want to go home at night and put the TV on and see their faces up there. I mean, he clearly had no idea what he was doing. And every move he made was the wrong move.
Right.
And when you listen to him talk, it sounded like this guy was insane. So I don't think Sandusky had a shot in hell with this guy representing him. Forget about him. Even if, you know, the greatest, if Clarence Darrow rose from the grave and came in there to represent him, you know, I don't know that anybody could have beaten this case, but maybe a deal could have been structured. Maybe something could have been worked out there. As it is now, he'll never see the light of day again. He will die in prison, and, you know, rightfully so. But this attorney that he had did no favors for him. I mean, he got horrible representation, and, you know, you see this time and time again. Yeah, you know, ineffective assistance of counsel is one of the big grounds. But, you know, everybody says, King Jordan, let me tell you, everyone says when they get, you know, these convictions and the lawyer, it's like a, when you go to the doctor and they tap your knee and it reflexes, oh, we're going to take an appeal. We're going to take an appeal. Do you know how many appeals are granted in criminal cases? I mean, I think it's less than 2%. It's such a low percentage that unless the trial judge is, you know, completely off their rocker, the appellate divisions and the district, the circuit courts are not going to reverse these convictions. They feel the jury has made their decision. They're the ones that heard the case, and this is what they came up with. Very difficult to get a reversal or a new trial. Very, very difficult. So, yeah, he can appeal it, and the appeal will go nowhere. He's going to die in prison.
Right, and you know, and you obviously know about Penn State. It seems like he got caught in 98 with regular police. They told him in 2004 when I was watching the 2020 special. It just seems like this guy was invincible in his own mind. He really thought...
That's the problem with most criminals. They don't think it all out, and they think they're the master of the universe, you know? They think they know it all. But they don't take into account every contingency, and this guy was just out in the open. And the problem that I have with the case, obviously I have problems with Sandusky, but to me, Joe Paterno, and I'm sorry he died, and I'm sorry that this was how his career ends with this stamp on it, but to me, Joe Paterno knew, he had to have known, I think he absolutely knew everything that was going on with Sandusky, and he didn't have the courage or the integrity to step up. He cared too much about protecting the football program down there. In 1998, he went to Sandusky and told him, after the initial criminal investigations, there's no way, pal, you are never going to be the head coach of Penn State, and in fact, you're done.
Right.
Okay? They told him that in 98. Why do you think they told him that? Why did Paterno do that? And then why did Paterno walk out of the dinner that they threw for Sandusky on his retirement? Because he was sickened by it, Paterno. And yet he did nothing. And this was his right-hand man. If you remember back then, and any listeners will remember, you know, in the 70s and 80s, Penn State was linebacker U. I mean, Penn State, that 4-4 defense at Penn State. Listen, if you played linebacker at Penn State, you signed a big, big pro contract. It was guaranteed. That's where you were going. Well, Sandusky ran the defense of linebacker U. And Sandusky was right there with Paterno every step of the way. For Joe Paterno to turn his head, despite all his rah-rah ethics and grades and everybody, you know, to me that's all bullshit now, because there he was, he had the ability to make a difference and stop it, and he didn't. So everything that transpired after 98, you know, Joe Paterno has to answer for that.
And after 98 was 2001, when allegedly Mike McCleary saw him in the shower, and Joe Paterno, you know, he told Shirley and Schultz, you know, what the story was, and then he just let it keep going around. Like, in other words, just don't bring the kids here, in essence, is what Joe Pa said.
Well, first of all, Mike McCleary, who they claim to be a hero, he's not a hero. He walked into a locker room and saw this animal raping a kid in the shower, and what did he do? He didn't go for a baseball bat and go in there and break Sandusky's head open. He ran home to his daddy.
He would have been a hero.
He said, "Daddy, daddy, what do I do, daddy?" And his father said, "Oh, you better tell Coach." So the next day, he decided to tell Paterno. But meanwhile, he left this kid in the shower with this animal, and did. And McQuarrie is not a little punk. He's a big guy. He's a big guy, McQuarrie. And, you know, the cover-up after that, and again, Paterno, not, they let him have an office there, emeritus, this Sandusky. He had keys. He had free rein. He had free tickets to every game on the road home. He was seen with kids on the campus, in the facilities, on the road with them in hotels. And none of these coaches at Penn State did anything. You know, I mean, to me, I've got a big problem with that.
Yeah, and Joe Amendola is going to say, and his Carl Warminger, they're going to say they only had 8 months and they couldn't get any continuations. And I believe Carl Warminger's quote was, I could get a continuance for a DWI, but I can't get one for Jerry Sandusky. How's that for an appeal?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's going to fly, but certainly – you know, they'll make their cry that they couldn't get all discovery. I mean, the government never turns over everything on time. Every case I have, I'm getting things the last minute. I mean, that's just how it is. You got to deal with it. That's how the procedure. You, if every case you wanted to take an appeal based on those grounds, it's not going to work. I mean, I get stuff the day that morning going into trial. I'm getting discovery turned over by the government. That's just until we change the laws. That's how it is. And, you know, the bulk of it comes in before the trial, but you get little tidbits continuing on during the course of the trial that are sometimes explosive. And, you know, it's just he was incompetent. That's the problem, Amendola. He should not have taken the case. He should have walked away from the case and let someone else with more experience handle it.
I believe he tried to remove himself, but the judge wouldn't let him. Just right before trial.
Yeah, that's too late in the game. That's way too late. It's very difficult in criminal cases to seek to be relieved, and the closer you get to trial, it's impossible.
Okay, we got this new evidence Google searching with Casey Anthony. Now, this is a double jeopardy, so she could basically admit that she killed her daughter and she cannot be tried. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. She could get on 60 Minutes right now and say, I did it. They couldn't prove it. Kiss my ass. I mean, she could do that. She's not going to do that, but she certainly could do that. I heard your discussion with Joe yesterday about that also. And, you know, I was covering that live on CNN.
They
went to the verdict, they went to me and I said, listen, people, this is a flash verdict. When you see a verdict this quick in a case like this, it's going to come back guilty. I mean, this woman is going to die. They are going to kill this woman. Seriously, literally kill her. You know, you can't make up a story that I brought my daughter to some nanny zanny who doesn't exist, and that's the last time I saw her. Those kind of stories don't fly in juries. And this, they went to the verdict, and then they came back to me and said, well, what do you think? And I said, well, just like I said, guilty. I mean, not guilty. What can you say? Anybody who watched that case, any legal mind who watched it had to think that the jury was never going to allow her to walk out of that courthouse, never going to let her walk out of prison. No way. I mean, clearly she was the one with her daughter, and the evidence seemed to indicate that she killed her daughter. Now, the jury said, okay, fine and dandy. They listened carefully to the jury instructions, and they determined that the prosecution did not prove that Casey Anthony was at the crime scene. That's
right.
What they came back with. No evidence whatsoever that Casey was at the crime scene. And that's what they relied on to acquit in this particular case. Now, in addition to that, you had this absolute horrendous prosecutor sitting there making faces. I tell my clients, if you show any emotion other than crying during a trial, I'm gonna put you in a headlock and put you to sleep. You want wrestling? I'm gonna give you a sleeper hold right in the courtroom. I'm not gonna let it happen. And this lunatic prosecutor, this pompous moron, sat there shaking his head, yes, no, laughing, making comments. And
right.
To me, from my purposes, Baez was inept. I mean, he's to me, he does not know how to cross-examine. He was not prepared, and yet he won the biggest case maybe of the century. I don't know. I don't know how he did it.
Or that the prosecution lost it.
Yeah, well, the prosecution lost it. I mean, the lead prosecutor, the woman, was absolutely, you know, you didn't need any no-dos or any type of sleeping pills because she could put you to sleep just standing up. And this, the other attorney, the second prosecutor, I'm not even going to dignify him by his name because he was just horrendous. He thought he was, you know, God's gift to the world. And, you know, people like Nancy Grace were crazy. Look, the prosecution team is incredible. These are the greatest lawyers I've ever seen in my life. And I'm on there telling her they're horrible. I'm sleeping. I'm snoring. I can't even follow them. And this guy's making me up. He's pissing me off sitting there. And it's arrogant, and he's fighting with Baez the way he was, and I'm glad Baez stuck it up his butt with the laughing man comment. You know, to his credit, Baez fought hard with everything he had, and again, I tip my hat to him, even though I would not let him handle a DWI case, because he does not know how to cross-examine people. He only had a couple years' experience as a lawyer, period, to walk into this type of case, but he won it. And he won it, and I tip my hat to him, and I respect the fact that he won probably the biggest case, you know, certainly in the last 50 years. I mean, it's a huge case.
A lot of people credit also his co-counsel, Cheney Mason. Your thoughts on him?
I know Cheney Mason from the case that I was involved in Orlando. Cheney's been around a long time, and, you know, he brings that southern gentlemanly charm into the courtroom, which I think the jury liked, and he was a good combination. You know, it was a good mix between him and Baez.
No question. Okay, let's turn to another case coming up. It is George Zimmerman versus Florida. Allegedly, George Zimmerman, stand your ground, tried to protect himself with an unknown Trayvon Martin. This is set to go to trial in June of 13. What's your thoughts on this whole case, as we know it so far?
My thought is that you better put your seatbelts on, because he's going to be acquitted. That's
really?
My thoughts. This man is going to walk, and you can say all you want about what he was doing that night and where he was. Based on the evidence that they have, Zimmerman will walk. And it's not a stand-your-ground case. It will not survive. It will survive that stand your ground hearing. He will not win that, and the reason is because there was a recent case in Florida where the top court there ruled on stand your ground. This is a case where a woman was in the house with her husband, and she had a gun in the house, and he beat the crap out of her in the house. She reached for the gun and ran out. And then she went back into the house and shot him. And she claimed stand your ground defense. And the court said, no, that's not stand your ground, because you feared him initially, and then you left. So the fear was gone. Then, by walking back into the house, well, you didn't fear him then. And so, therefore, stand your ground does not apply. And in this particular instance, if you listen to Zimmerman's testimony, he was actually chasing the kid for a while.
Right.
So, you know, the imminent fear, the fear of imminent bodily harm or death is not there, obviously, if he's chasing the kid. Now, the evidence is going to show that he retreated back to his car and that Trayvon Martin came up to him and there was an altercation and Trayvon beat the crap out of him. And during the course of that, Zimmerman's the evidence is going to show Zimmerman pulled the gun and shot him at close range. Now, it wasn't like he shot him in the back or in the back of the head. He shot him dead on to his chest, and he's got the marks on the back of his head. He's saying Trayvon was pounding him into the ground. Now, look, at that point in time, on a straight self-defense, you have the right to shoot someone if you have a gun. And that's how this case is going to play out. It's not going to be as some of the media outlets have, where they show Trayvon Martin when he was 12 years old riding a bike, and blowing out birthday candles. I mean, this kid was like 6 feet. He played varsity football down there. He hit the weight room. He was a big kid. And he broke Zimmerman's nose. He hit him flush in the nose, and he's got the cuts on the back of his head. So it's not, I can understand, and people think it's a racial thing and this and that. And, you know, there may be riots after this verdict. It's going to be bad. But I think Zimmerman's going to walk.
Yeah, I was going to say, the pictures that they throw up there is like 4 or 5 years ago. And the last picture of him when he's in 7-Eleven, you're right, he's like 6 foot something at least.
Yeah. Zimmerman, he's no hero and he's no angel Zimmerman. But at the end of the day, if this guy is getting his head pounded into the sidewalk and his head is cut in the back and is bleeding and his nose is broken from being punched in the nose and he pulls a gun and shoots, that's self-defense. What happens if he killed Zimmerman? Then what? You know, what would we be saying then if Trayvon Martin killed him there? So, look, Zimmerman, you know, Trayvon, should he have continued to run away? Yeah, he should have. I mean, he should have. But, you know, machismo, I don't know what it is. He confronted Zimmerman, and now look at the result we have. Terrible result.
You think the special prosecutor is overcharging?
I think the special prosecutor is insane. Comes from Florida, obviously, so I have my feelings about Florida prosecutors. But this one also was told to do a job. I mean, just think. They're doing their investigation. There's no indictment yet. So they decide to hire a special prosecutor. And what? Within 48 hours, he's indicted. So, look, she got her marching orders. I'm not impressed with her. She doesn't have it in the case. She overcharged the second-degree murder, and she's going to pay for that.
No question. No question about that. And that'll be coming up on June. Do you think the weight of Dwayne Wade and a lot of these celebrities, it made an impact on it. I think even the president got involved with this. Why isn't there why aren't they looking into this, blah, blah, blah. And then the next thing you know, he's charged. Do you think the celebrity factor weighed
it? I don't know so much as the celebrity factor, but politically in the state of Florida, you know, they wanted an indictment here. They wanted Zimmerman indicted. So someone gave the marching orders, and there it was, indict him. I mean, Zimmerman had the right to carry a gun. He was licensed to carry. And under those circumstances, I believe, based on what I've seen in the evidence, he had the right to use that gun to defend himself, which is what he did. And it's going to be as simple as that. And that's how the case is going to come down to the jury. And look, juries can do anything. We've seen it. Look, Casey Anthony, you've seen it all. O.J. Simpson, you've seen it all. But, I think Zimmerman's going to walk.
Yeah. It's all about the jurors, I think. You know, can you tell our listeners what a jury consultant is?
Jury consultants are really taking over, I'd say, in the last 8 to 10 years or so. They're becoming quite useful for defense attorneys now, or even prosecution or any attorney in any particular case. But, you know, you talk about two different types of justice. And, you know, if I'm representing a kid in the Bronx on a murder case, well, he's not going to be able to afford a jury consultant. But if you're going to represent someone in a high-profile case where there's money, then you're going to get a jury consultant. And you hire these people usually – they have PhD degrees in psychology, and they're able to take a certain fact pattern and help you with your jury preparation and your jury selection. And perhaps they provide you with certain psychological questions to elicit from jurors what they're thinking, to see if they have any predisposed notions about a case, or if they think a certain way, perhaps about the death penalty or about just anything in general. And a lot of these jury consultants will give you a mock trial where you can actually put on a trial before the actual trial. And they bring in jurors. You rent out a conference room in a hotel, and you bring in a group of jurors to listen to bits and pieces of your case, and you test certain arguments in front of them. And they give you feedback on what they think was good or what they think is unbelievable. And in some instances, if you're thinking of your client testifying, you can run you know, a mock testimony of your client and get some feedback on what the jurors think of your client. And that's usually very helpful when, you know, you don't want to put your client on the stand and yet they think, oh, I've got to testify. And you say, well, look what the jurors thought of you. They thought you were an animal. So they're never going to believe you. Please, you can't do it. But jury consultants usually run about $25,000 and up. Very useful. I'd love to have one on every trial that I do, even if I can pick their brain on one thing that will help me during a trial, it's worth it for me. But, you know, they're expensive.
Absolutely. The Drew Peterson trial, which the judge allowed, it hearsay evidence. Give me your thoughts on the hearsay evidence, the verdict, and the whole case in a nutshell.
I think that Drew Peterson is his own worst enemy.
Right.
And if Drew Peterson had just shut up and gone about his life, instead of mocking law enforcement, mocking the police, mocking the media, acting like a he infuriated everyone who saw this guy. I mean, he was just a horrendous person. It's like OJ. If he had just gone on playing golf, stopped messing around, stopped doing stupid things, just play. You got away with murder, OJ. Thank your lucky stars. Play golf. Do what you do. Collect your $250,000, $300,000 pension, which nobody can touch every year, and sign your autographs and do your thing. You know, it wasn't good enough. So, like OJ couldn't help himself, you know, Peterson couldn't help himself, and he gets thrust with an indictment for murder. I think that the judge really – I don't think the judge knows what the law is. I think that he missed the day in law school when they taught law. I think the verdict was absolutely horrendous to get a murder conviction based solely on hearsay evidence. To me, is an abomination. And I think he's going to win his appeal on that, based on that lack of sufficiency of evidence.
No question. But if the Drew Peterson was his worst enemy, if he would have just kept quiet, like you said, he wouldn't have been back in court. And Salvio, when they did that first investigation, do you think since he worked with police that maybe they didn't do a proper full investigation?
I know. There's the blue shield there and the blue wall and everything else, and police officers look out for each other, and I'm sure they do, like in every profession and every job out there. But, I don't know. It looked pretty thorough to me. They had a pathologist, you know, look at the body and make certain findings. I mean, this person's license was on the line, and, you know, they made certain findings. They bring in Michael Bodden, who's a hired gun, to say that, you know, he thinks it's murder, and that's exactly what he says. So it depends who you can bring. These experts are not independent. They say they're independent, but if they're brought in by the government or they're brought in by the defense, you're going to get a perspective based on who's paying their bill. So, you know, they're not independent, and, you know, they're persuasive. They're very persuasive, and Michael Bodden was instrumental in getting that case looked at again and in getting the indictment. But to just think about a conviction of murder, the highest crime we have, because someone told me that he said this to them, and then you get a conviction for murder? Come on.
Right. But what about in your heart of hearts? Forget about the lawyer. Your lawyer has. Do you think Drew Peterson did this?
I don't. What? To me, why would he do it? I mean, what's the motivation? What's the upside to him? He was already divorced. What's the upside to him to do this? I don't know. I don't think he was that crazy. But then again, anybody whose three wives are dead, I mean, that's a problem. So I don't know. I can't follow the criminal mind. The jury spoke on that one. I think he's going to look at a reversal on appeal or a new trial just on the evidentiary rulings there. The third wife is gone. You know, I don't know how they're ever going to tie him into the third wife.
Do you think the jurors secretly, you know, in their hearts, you know, thought about that third wife? Even though they weren't asked to consider that, do you think, you know, they're human and everything, do you think they considered all that?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I think they are human, and I do think they consider those things, and I think they ignore some of the jury instructions, because trust me, listen, I sit and listen to jury instructions all the time. I have to concentrate to understand the instructions.
Right.
And I'm practicing over 30 years. If a layperson is sitting there hearing the instructions for the first time, I know they have no clue what the judge is instructing them on. They don't know. There's no way they can possibly understand unless they have legal training. So the judge can get up there and, for the record, charge the jury, you know, and I heard you talking about reasonable doubt yesterday, and you talk about this and that. Look, the jurors are going to do in their heart what they think is right. And the images of the fact that Peterson had, you know, the third wife is dead, the second wife is dead, he's mocking the police, he's putting his mush up on the news every 2 seconds and bad-mouthing everybody. You know, that comes into play. It absolutely comes into play. This O.J., he got convicted in Las Vegas. Listen, he should have been convicted in the first case. And in the second case, he should have walked. But the jurors hated him because they remembered the first trial. In this second O.J. case, he called the FBI and said, I'm going to the hotel to get my stolen property.
He
did that in advance. They knew he was going there.
Nobody's leaving, right?
Don't nobody move with someone holding a gun, and that's what did it for him.
Now, can you explain a little bit to our younger callers and new callers about the 95 O.J. case? Talk a little about the judge. Talk about what went wrong for the prosecution.
Well, again, you know, you get incompetent prosecutors who don't know what they're doing. They have all the resources in the world. They have detectives. They have police. They have, you know, assistant district attorneys. They have everybody there at their beck and call. And they, you know, when they don't put together the case airtight, they leave things open. They don't interview properly. They put a guy like Furman up on the stand, who I heard Joey talk about how he appreciates Furman because he's on Fox, and Furman's on Fox all the time. I think Furman is an absolute freak job. I can't believe anybody would ever listen to him after his testimony in that case. F. Lee Bailey, who I know, annihilated him on cross-examination and completely nuked all of his credibility. So Furman, to me, is, you know, he's an ant. He's nothing. But the Marsha Clark, who also, incredibly, is on these legal shows giving legal – who is she to give legal advice? She lost the biggest case around, the easiest case in the world to win. The guy was running away. Everyone in the world saw him in the car. They didn't bring that evidence in. This woman has lost her mind. I don't know who she is. I go on some of these shows and she's on, and I keep saying, OJ, how could you lose that case? I don't let anybody forget that. I mean, to me, she's horrendous. She writes books. She got new hairstyles. It's ridiculous. Really, what is she doing? Why are anybody – at least Chris Darden went away and hid somewhere. I think he's a law professor. He went away. He wrote his book, and he's hiding. That's where he should be. But her, what is she doing getting front and center, giving legal advice? Who would listen to her? They didn't prepare properly. As soon as they said to him, put that glove on, and it didn't fit. And you got Johnny Cochran in there, who, you know, in his day was one of the best in the country, did his thing. You had a substantially all-black jury who O.J. Simpson is a hero to them. And it didn't matter how the evidence came down. Didn't matter if there was blood in his truck all over him or whatever. It just didn't matter. You know, he's the hero. And they looked for a couple avenues to hang their hat on, and the prosecution was inept and gave it to him. And O.J. walked on a case that, to this day, you listen to Paul Mooney talk, he thinks there was drugs involved. He thinks there were other people involved. You know Paul Mooney, the comedian?
Okay,
he says he knows O.J., he knew the family, he knew everybody intimately. I don't know. I don't know if there were drugs involved or not. All I know is she was brutally slaughtered, and the man with him, his head almost was completely severed off. That's a violent act. That's a violent death. And O.J. walked. And to me, that was a lights out, hands down conviction.
Right. Well, I was going to say, was this like the James Holmes case? Was this expected to be an open shut case?
I mean, you would think so. O.J., despair, driving with his friend in the car, running away, fleeing. You know, flight is evidence of a crime. It's evidence of guilt. Why they didn't admit that during that trial, someone's going to have to give me that answer one of these days, because to me, as a juror, even though I knew it, I'd like to see it. But one other thing, let me just touch on this. We talked about jurors. You know, there are these stealth jurors, these jurors who will sit in front of you and say, when you ask them, have you heard or read or anything about this case or any of the parties involved here, and they look at you and they go, no. And yet they have their own secret agendas. They get on these juries, and it's almost impossible to cull them out. They make the jury selection. They get in there, and some of them, you know, are able to impact verdicts, and there's just nothing you can do. Our system is not perfect. It's by far, it is not perfect. But I tell you this from the bottom of my heart, without a doubt, it is the absolute best system in the world. In the world. But it's not perfect.
And now these pot laws that have came up, you spoke on CNN, they're going to be legal in, I believe, Washington and Colorado. Two-part question, is that true? And if so, when will New York get this?
Well, you're interested, huh? You want to know when it's going to be legal for you. Okay.
Well, you know, I fear that, you know, with what's available, cigarettes is much more dangerous, and alcohol kills people. We haven't seen any deaths linked to marijuana alone.
In Los Angeles, they have more medical pot dispensaries than Starbucks right now.
Really?
In Los Angeles. Here's the problem with the states that are enacting laws for legalizing marijuana, pot, whatever. The federal laws, the federal supremacy clause, means that federal law trumps state law. Federal law is more important than state law. So if a state says, okay, pot's legal, yet under federal law it is illegal, it's illegal. So
right.
It's not going to be a defense. Well, hey, Colorado law says I can do this. Conviction. Federal conviction. So until – and look, Holder has got his hands full on Benghazi. He's got his hands full on so many different fronts right now that, you know, he's not going to address these states that are enacting these laws right now, I don't believe. But, you know, the president is going to have to step up and take a position on this, because these laws contradict each other, and the states will lose. The federal government wins every single time. So, you know, you got to be careful. Even if you're in a state that legalizes it, and say New York comes through and says, yes, it's okay, you have to be careful, because it's not okay, and you can be federally prosecuted. And that's a good piece of legal advice for you and for all your listeners, because it's just not that simple of a state approving it.
Well, I had a friend, he told me he was, walking around, and they caught him with a joint, and it's illegal here in New York, and they were undercover cops, and what happened was they threw him in there with murderers and everything else like that, and remember, this is one joint and nothing else, and he went through the whole procedure thing, and it was a nightmare for him. These undercover cops, should this have happened for one joint?
You know, it depends on the police officer. It depends on where their heads are at. They've got the discretion. But just so you know, if you get arrested in New York City, in the borough of Manhattan, and you go through central booking, you're not coming out for about 36 hours. So people think at least you're going to go in, you know, I'll be out in a few hours. Oh, no. You're going to be in central booking. You're going to get your fingerprints, your pictures taken. Then they're going to bring you to the tombs. You're going to get lost in the tombs somewhere. You're going to be mixed in with everybody under the sun, eating cheese sandwiches and just, you know, waiting. When is my lawyer, when is my family getting me out of here? You know, get me before a judge. And it takes a good 36 hours to be processed in the state of New York. Now, federal case, much quicker. Much quicker on a federal case. But a state case, it's brutal. And was it a crime? Yes. I mean, possession of a joint is a crime. You know, it comes in at a misdemeanor level, which is a crime. And they had every right to arrest him and put him through the process. Just think if they arrested everybody in the city who they caught with a joint, what would be going on in the prison? I mean, it's I think most police don't arrest off one joint. But well, you can't fault these guys. They followed the law. They did what they thought was best.
Well, you heard of these narcotics team, right? Where they,
yes,
they're undercover. They dress up. They have like a Giambi jersey on and a Yankee hat. And that's how they get these, people doing their joints and smoking their stuff. And a lot of people will tell me that they have a quota to reach. And that's really what it's all about. It's a numbers game. They're just a number.
And you notice they wear Yankee hats, not Met hats. They wear Yankee hats.
Yeah, yeah, right.
It's tough. The undercovers are tough. I've been through many trials, and I've seen undercover FBI agents that, man, you would never see them coming. Trust me. You would never, ever see them coming at you. So, yeah, there's a lot of undercover state and federal out there, and if you're going to play and you're going to commit a crime, you know, you better be prepared to do the time because there's, you know, a lot of good law enforcement out there. I criticize law enforcement. I punch holes in what they do. But at the end of the day, you know, if someone's breaking into my house, I want to be able to call the police to come. And I think most people feel that way. But there are rogue agents. There are rogue cops. There are bad cops. There are horrible cops. And there are horrible FBI agents. And you know, I do my best to expose them.
Well, if Bloomberg's son got caught, let's just say, for example, with a joint, I'm sure that that process of 36 hours would be much less. Right?
Yeah, if Daddy made a phone call, I think probably within an hour he was through the system, right? That's how
speaking
it goes.
Speaking of Bloomberg, and I asked this to Joey, what was your thought process on how he handled Sandy, you know, with the marathon and, you know, it's on and it's off with the Knicks and Nets and it's on, it's off, you know.
It's tough. You want to try to get people back as quick as possible to the normal routines. And, you know, to even consider running the marathon, I think was kind of disgraceful. And I'm glad that they shut it down and didn't run it. I mean, from what I read, the amount of money that would have been going into generators and things like that, where there are people that, you know, are sleeping in the streets and don't, can't, you know, their homes are destroyed, and it's just a tragic situation. I guess overall Bloomberg handled it pretty good. You know, what would you do in those circumstances? You know, I don't know. I'm glad he canceled the marathon, and I don't know. It was tough to get around to get to the Garden to see a basketball game, so I don't even know how people, you know, even when they started playing, got there. It was very tough on the subways, especially from Brooklyn.
Right, even if you had the cars, you had the gas. It was hard to get gas.
Yeah, you couldn't get gas. People, my nephew is writing to me, he's posting on Facebook. Yeah, 4:15 in the morning, I finally got gas. You know, I mean, it was crazy. It was just what a tragedy, though. And you know, you got to tip your hat to Bloomberg and also to Christie in Jersey. I mean, you know, drop all the political garbage and just help the people, man. Just, you know, do everything you can to help the people and these artists that put these performances on to try to raise money for the charities. I mean, it's so wonderful. And that's, you know, that's what this country is about. Everybody wants to badmouth this, that, everything. You know, we come out of that horrible, you know, really a nasty election and just nastiness all around. And then you see politicians act the way they're supposed to act. It was nice.
Obama visited Governor Christie, and that was like right before the election. A lot of people say that that last impression of Obama in Jersey with the suffering people of Sandy led to maybe him getting a second term. What's your thoughts on that?
You know, President Clinton called Romney right after the election and told him, listen, you lost the election because of Sandy.
Really?
Because there was Obama being the president of the United States. And there he was, didn't care what Christie was, Republican or Democrat or what. He was working with him across party lines to help people who were suffering. And that image of the two of them, and believe me, Christie took it hard too. I mean, Republicans were criticizing him. How could you do this? How could you hang out with – but he didn't care. The president didn't care. And I don't believe it was a publicity stunt. I think it was real. I think the devastation was so – some of these towns in Jersey, I don't know if they're ever going to come back. And, you know, I tip my hat to both of those politicians. They really – I think they did everything they could. And, look, it probably did swing the election his way. Incredibly so. I can't believe Romney was even that close, but that goes back to my thoughts that on the election and Obama. I mean, and I go independent, but I mean, come on, the guy has done so much during the last 4 years that he's not getting credit for. So I think he deserves
a lot
more.
People are anti-Obama, and I'm in the middle. I'm like you. I'm independent. What are some of the positive things that we could tell our listeners that Obama has done that people aren't giving him credit for?
Well, Wall Street's still here, so
right.
That's number one. He saved Wall Street. He saved the car companies. They were done. They were all done. All the car companies were done. So,
Bin Laden.
You know, he got Bin Laden under his reign. the Somali pirate took one between the eyes under his call. You know,
right.
If the raid to get Obama went bad, Bin Laden, if the raid to get Bin Laden turned into a Jimmy Carter fiasco, that was it for Obama. I mean, there's no way he could win another election. And he made the call on going in there. If they had gone in there and Bin Laden wasn't there, that would have cost him the election. I mean, it was courageous what he did. You talk about, you know, President Kennedy and profiles and courage. I mean, this is one of them. And, I mean, he made that call. So people have amnesia as to the state of the country the last year of President Bush. I mean, they really do. And time to wake up, people. The man has worked hard the last 4 years. It's coming back slowly, not as fast as everyone wanted. It's not perfect. We've got a long way to go. But don't forget, when he ran for election the first time, he ran on health care. He said, I'm going to put in health care. And he won by a landslide. And then he got elected, and he put in health care. And everybody bitched and moaned about it. And guess what? He won again. So deal with it. Just deal with it now. It's here.
Yeah. A lot of people said the lesser of two evils, but you bring up some great points with Obama. I want to talk to you about something that you defense attorneys have to do, and it's a special skill, and if you could teach our maybe listeners, it's called cross-examination. Can you define it, and how do you become good at it?
Well, cross-examination is the great equalizer. I mean, it's very simple for a prosecutor to get up there and work with their witness. And by the way, don't think they don't work with their witnesses. I mean, it's like a Broadway show. They sit down with them with, you know, their detectives or FBI agents, and they rehearse and they rehearse. And I go up there and I ask, how many times have you rehearsed with the government prior to testifying today? And I get objections, and the judges let it go. So it's good. They rehearse. They rehearse their testimony. When you're planning to do that, it comes out nice, you know. It comes out smooth. The story comes out. But cross-examination, again, is the great equalizer. That's when you get an opportunity to stand up and basically examine the credibility of what the witness just testified to. And in many cases, you know, that's where you earn your stripes as a defense attorney, as a civil attorney. In any case, you earn your stripes on cross-examination. How do you get better at it? It's not a skill that you can read a book and get good at. You need to be up there in the fire doing it. You have to know when to ask a question, when not to ask a question, when to keep your mouth shut, you know, when not to subpoena a certain witness and get annihilated, like what happened in the Peterson case, where the attorney decided to call the matrimonial attorney. I mean, you just have to know. Yeah, you have to know when to shut up, too. Sometimes you don't ask a certain question, and you don't, as a general rule, you do not ask a question that you do not know the answer to or that you cannot support, you know, the response you want. So it's a skill. It's acquired over time, and there's a learning curve, and it continues on every trial for every attorney. I don't care who they are. They learn during the course of their cross-examinations.
What about opening statement? How do you prepare for that?
Opening statement is pretty much as Joey talked about you last night. See, I did listen to you yesterday. I just want you to know that.
Yeah.
The government in a criminal case will get up there and lay it out there. You know, we were going to show that they intentionally killed this person and everything under the sun, and they lay it out there in their opening. You're only supposed to show what you intend to prove at trial, either whether it's a civil case or a criminal case. The opening statement is just what the facts will show, and that's pretty much it. And depending on the judge, that will determine how much leeway you will get. If I don't get at least 3 objections during my opening, I am not doing my job. I try to do a summation in my opening. I take it as far as I can to show the jury the flip side of the coin, to show the jury where we're coming from. May not necessarily be what the evidence will prove, but I want them thinking a different way, because the trial will last several days or weeks or months, and I don't want them to get embedded in their minds what the prosecutor is telling them the case is all about. You know, I talk about 2 sides of a coin. And I got to get them thinking another way. Otherwise, some jurors could just think in their mind throughout the whole trial, well, the government said this, so that's how it is. Think about it. If someone gets indicted, what comes to mind? What do you think about that person? King, tell me what you think. If they told you Joe Schmo just got indicted, what are your thought processes about this person?
Well, you're going to think he's guilty, probably.
Right, and that's what happens. What happened to innocent until proven guilty? What happened to that?
I think it's guilty until proven innocent or proven not guilty.
And that's what people think, and that's what jurors think. If the government indicted you, you're bad, you did bad things, you deserve to be punished. And it's just not like that.
Like that Duke lacrosse case back in 06.
Oh, my God. The veins in my neck almost popped out. I started criticizing this prosecutor from the beginning. I started blasting Duke University.
Great.
Yeah, I went off on this case so bad. He never had the evidence there. He never had it with these guys. And to do what he did, he's in prison. That's where he belongs. He's an animal. When prosecutors do this, they're animals. I mean, they're murderers is what they are. You think about it.
What is the motive of a prosecutor to do this?
That's political gain. He has to run for election. This guy was a second string guy his whole career. He's stepping up. He wanted to be the head prosecutor there, the district attorney. So he did everything he could. He lied. He cheated. He hid evidence. Look, this guy, Nifong, was an absolute horrendous animal, and when prosecutors do this to people, you just don't understand. You get knocked down in a federal criminal case based on the federal sentencing guidelines, you can go to prison for 50 years. You can get 50, and you've got to do 85% of the time. There's no 50-50, get out early, go to a halfway house. It's 85% on a federal criminal conviction sentencing. It's not like, you know, what people think. The federal sentencing guidelines are off the wall. There must be reform there. They must be brought back to reality, because you can go to prison. It's a death sentence. And when a prosecutor is corrupt and you get corrupt convictions, you know, there's no DNA. We see the Innocence Project, and we hear time and time again of exonerations of people on death row. The DNA exonerated them. They're not guilty. Oh, man, how close was that? Let's get go home. We're sorry. Okay. But in a white-collar case or a fraud or a corporate fraud kind of case, there ain't no DNA. So if you get 50 years in prison and you're 50 years old, you're going to die in prison. That's a death sentence.
Wow. Now, we were talking about opening statements. Your thoughts on Jose Baez's opening statement back to the Casey Anthony case?
Look, the rule of thumb, and there's rule of thumbs in every case, and I guess, you know, in that particular case, he had to do anything, and he did. He tried to show the jury a different position, something he could not prove at trial, and I'm surprised that there were no ethics complaints brought against him where he had to sit and actually demonstrate the basis or foundation for some of the claims he made in his opening, because ethically speaking, you can't get up there and make pronouncements of things that without some kind of support. And I guess he would say at that time, well, Casey told me this, and I relied on my client, that's why. But to come off with the accusations that he threw out there with the inability to prove them, I mean, he did not have one scintilla of evidence to prove some of these outrageous claims he was making in the opening. I mean, rule 101 opening statements. You do not do that, because in the end, the government stands up and says, remember in the opening, remember when the defense attorney told you he was going to prove this and prove this and prove this? Meanwhile, as Joey told you, the defense doesn't have to prove anything. But take it upon yourself – if you put an affirmative obligation on yourself that you're going to prove something to this jury, and you tell them that, and you don't do it, then the jury sees that. They see they can't trust you. You're unreliable. Therefore, your whole case is unreliable. You're convicted. Very dangerous move. Yet in that case, he had to, because the facts were just off the wall. I mean, the facts, this woman, this compulsive liar, this serial compulsive liar, with the, you know, with the kid a stone's throw from the house, is just, you know, again, I think he was inept. I wouldn't let him represent anybody I know, yet I tip my hat to him because he won the case. He won it. I don't know how he won it, but he won it.
Did you think Roy Kronk was a huge presence for the defense?
I think Roy Kronk is a whack job. I don't know how he infused himself in this case, looking in the woods, making reports, coming back, making further reports. You know, we're never going to know the true story about Roy Kronk there. But, he was not the end all. I don't think he impacted the jury. I think what happened in that case, and I know that they had a jury consultant, and I know halfway through the trial, the jury consultant hired a number of paralegals and other people to monitor social websites and get a feel for what people were saying about the trial. And about halfway through the trial, the feelings that were coming out on Twitter and on Facebook and other social media sites were that the public hated George. They didn't trust him. They didn't like him. So if you recall the second half of that trial, They started teeing off on George any chance they could get. And
basically the defense.
Excuse me?
They put George on trial.
Yeah.
George.
And he's having an affair, and his wife didn't know about it. And, you know, and he didn't. George, he tried to kill himself. And, you know, that's why this new evidence that looks like the prosecution missed, these how do you do a perfect suffocation? I mean, so if they had it, you know, Baez would say, that's George. George already tried to kill himself once, and this is, you know, his way of trying to kill himself again. I mean, you know, you could easily get around that. So people should not get up in arms that this would have made a difference in the verdict. I don't think it would. I don't think it would have impacted this verdict at all. I think the jury, some of those jurors got stuck in their mind, the jury instructions, and they thought, where's the proof that Casey was at this crime scene? And there was none. And that was it. That's what they hung their hat on.
Yeah, no question. What was your thought process of about Nancy Grace? She practically, you know, she was really invested into this case. She called the top mom all the time, and she called the jurors cookie jurors or something of that nature.
Yeah.
I know you
well,
go
look,
on a lot.
Nancy's entertainment, okay? That's
right.
Nancy is entertainment. So once you understand that, then you know she has her feelings as a crime victim herself, and so she thinks if anybody is even accused of a crime, they should get the death penalty. So forget about trial, forget about anything, just kill them. They were accused, kill them. And look, to her defense in this case, everybody thought that there was going to be a conviction here. And the question was she going to get the death penalty or not? But I don't know any attorney, and I've spoken to so many at that time who
right.
thought she had a legitimate chance of an acquittal. not a hung jury, an acquittal.
Right.
I mean,
not manslaughter.
Shocking.
Right.
Shocking.
I thought maybe manslaughter.
Yeah. Manslaughter should have been the verdict, by the way. But they went for the death penalty, so that's what happens when you overcharge and you go for death penalty. This is what you get.
Yeah, before we let you go, I want to talk to you about the West Memphis 3. Can you tell me what went wrong there, and you know, and about the Alford plea?
Which one is this now?
The West Memphis 3, where all the celebrities got involved. Johnny Depp. They allegedly killed three boys, and they were in there for over 20-plus years. I don't know if you followed it or not.
No, I didn't follow this one. I'm sorry. I did not follow this story.
Oh, okay. You didn't follow. Okay, so let's touch on Dr. Conrad Murray, which I know you did follow.
Yeah,
what's your thoughts on that case?
Conrad Murray, you know something? I got hammered with a lot of emails on this one. And here's the thing with Conrad Murray. Michael Jackson was killing himself for years. Nobody cared. Nobody did anything. His family just sucked off him financially all these years. Where was Tito? Where was Janet and Jermaine and the whole gang and Papa Jackson and Mama Jackson when their Michael was giving himself propofol for so many years, doing all these crazy drugs? You know, locking himself up in homes like he did. Where were they? Where was the intervention? Where was bringing him to a hospital? Who cared about him? They didn't care. To make Conrad Murray the face of the murderer of Michael Jackson, to me, is ridiculous. Michael Jackson was his murderer. He murdered himself. Now, having said that, the fact that someone would utilize propofol, which is anesthesia,
right,
in a house setting,
right,
without proper protocols, in and of itself, is gross negligence. And that's all that was required for the manslaughter conviction. And that's what they got, a manslaughter conviction. They didn't go for murder because they were smart. They never would have got murder. But to get the manslaughter conviction, it was charged properly, and, you know, Conrad Murray has to answer for that. He financially, he was strapped. He had an opportunity to make some money. He took it, despite the fact in his heart, I believe he knew it was wrong. Nobody gives propofol in a house setting like that. You just don't do it. And they were not able to prove Jackson administered it to himself. The jury didn't buy that. And, look, he was a doctor hired to make this guy sleep. I mean, you see the amount of medicine he was pumping in his system between the Xanax and just everything under the sun. It's just Ativan. Do you know what Ativan is? I mean, do you know what intravenous? I had cancer, okay? I had leukemia. They were giving me intravenous Ativan when I was taking chemo. And within 15 minutes of getting the Ativan, I was unconscious. I mean, unconscious. Now, I'm 6'2", 250 pounds, unconscious. Michael Jackson was, what, 6 feet, 130 pounds? And he's
right.
taking Ativan, and he's mixing it with Xanax, and mixing it. Just incredible.
Yeah, but they didn't overcharge, you don't feel. They just did one count, and they did do a good job with that. You feel that prosecution team of David Wolverine?
They did a great job. Those prosecutors did a great job. And you know what? The defense attorneys did a great job, too. They did the best they could with what they had to work with, and I was very impressed with both sides of the tables in that case. And I was just thinking there'd be one juror there who would say, you know what? I'm not going to put this all on this guy. Michael Jackson has to answer for his own insane behavior. It's insane. I mean, it's not in the realm of reality what this guy was doing to himself. Really. There's no two ways about it. You can't – nobody can rationalize what he was doing to himself. And if you think he could have done this tour, if you think those tour operators had his best interests in mind, because they clearly didn't, there's no way he could have done this tour. I mean, this guy was so frail. I mean, he was 130 pounds, 6 feet tall. 6'1", I think.
Reportedly, there was an email sent that Randy Phillips and said, Kenny Ortega said, that he was drunk right before the press conference in London. So he was pretty much a mess. He was strapped for cash. And, you know, I think he needed to rush to do this. So
yeah, Michael Jackson living in a rented home in California because they foreclosed on Neverland Ranch. This is the guy that owned the Beatles catalog. Paul McCartney says they were talking one day, and when they did their Ebony and Ivory thing, and
right.
Michael Jackson looks up to him and says, "I'm going to buy your catalog." And McCartney was like, "No, I'm buying it." And Michael Jackson outbid him and bought the Beatles catalog. I mean, how's this guy living in a rental home? Isn't he like a multi-billionaire? I don't know. He's a drug addict, and most drug addicts on that level die. And he died. And he's got to take, you know, people have to understand, he has, some of that burden goes on Michael Jackson and his own destructive behavior.
That's absolutely some good points you bring out there. But he definitely could have said no and walked away. That's Conrad Murray would agree, right?
Excuse me? Conrad Murray?
He could have definitely said no and walked away.
Yeah. I mean, they would have made a deal for Conrad Murray. Oh, he could have walked away from taking the retention. Yeah, he could have. But, you know, he was strapped for money. He needed money. And he had all his girlfriends and everything, so it was an expensive life for him. So he needed the money. His practice wasn't thriving. So sometimes when someone offers you a big number like that, they offer you six figures plus and a big weekly payout and a big monthly, you know, sometimes lawyers, doctors – people, they take the numbers. They want the money.
What was your thought on that, Judge Mike Pasker?
Yeah. He ran a pretty tight ship there. There weren't too many rulings that I was really questioning, so there's nowhere, I don't believe there's anywhere to go on appeal in that particular case. And he's just going to have to ride out and finish his time and he's going to get stripped. I mean, once you get convicted of a felony, you lose your license. And he's lost his license in California, and he's going to lose it in Texas and in Vegas, Nevada. So he's not going to be able to practice medicine. And I don't know what he's going to do, but he'll see the light of day again. That's one thing.
Yeah, only a couple more years for Dr. Murray. The judge on the Casey Anthony case, before we let you go, Belvin.
Yeah. You know, Belvin Perry, he had to deal with Baez, who didn't know how to frame a question and didn't know what the rules of evidence were, so he had his hands full.
Right.
I think he was more shocked than anybody on the verdict, but there's nothing he could have done about it. The jury spoke, and you know, that case could have gotten completely out of control. There were already contempt issues and everything. And look, Tobias's credit, he stood up and was honorable when he could have burned the prosecutors on a few points there on the contempt issues. But overall, I think he controlled the case better than what they initially had lined up for it. So he moved it along, got the verdict, but I think he almost fell out of his chair when he heard it.
Right. Richard Herman, criminal defense attorney. Do you have a Twitter?
At Richard B. Herman, yeah.
Okay, I want to thank you a million for coming on. We're about ready to have our sports guru, Mighty Quinn, come on. So thank you so much.
Loved it. The King, you're great, and I look forward. We'll do it again, okay?
Okay, Richard. Thanks a million.
Take care.
Okay, let's bring into the conversation Mighty Quinn from New York Daily News. Mighty, are you there?
How come you never thank me a million when I come on? Right? Who's that, Blackjack?
Blackjack
in the background?
Yeah,
how come I never get thanked a million? I get a one. I get a one thanks. I guess one better than none, right?
Well, we certainly thank
you. He must have been a big shot. I don't know who it was.
That was Richard Herman from CNN.
Okay.
And a legal counsel as well.
Oh, nice of him. Come on.
Right, absolutely. Okay, we got some news. Well, we don't know news, but free agent Josh Hamilton, will he be a Yankee?
Did you hear something today?
What's that?
Did you hear something today?
No, but Blackjack Brown told me that he heard some rumors.
I guess I heard the Mets were going to offer David Wright an 8-year contract. Did you hear that?
$145 million.
How much? 145?
Yes.
Wow, for 8 years?
I think they have to do it.
I guess he's going to grab that, yeah. Well, if I was David Wright, what is he, 32 years old? That'll put him to 40? I think he's 32, right?
Yeah. He's like 32 or 30, somewhere in that.
But going back to the Hamilton, I wouldn't be surprised if the Yankees go after him. Well, they got Suzuki and Wright and Grandison in the center, and then left is the... is that your... And left field, they got the... who was the guy? Gardner, that was out most of the year. I guess they could use a little power out there. I know Grandison hit a lot of homers, but Suzuki doesn't hit too many, but he gets on a lot.
What about Swishalicious?
About who?
Swishalicious.
I can't hear that well.
Nick Swisher.
Oh, Switzer. He wants to test the waters. I think I'd let him go. You know, he had a chance to shine his option and come back for another year. He's going to test the waters. I was surprised at him. I don't know if he's got too many offers. I always liked him. I guess he's all right, but he hasn't done well in the playoffs the last 2 years.
No question about that. Nick Snitz yesterday, did you catch it?
I was taking a lot of heat for that today because I don't know if you know, if you read yesterday's column at the bottom, you know, I pick a game every day, so I took. Now, I had told you after 50 years rooting for the Knicks, I had switched over to the Nets because I was born in Brooklyn.
Right.
So they play, right, for the first time last night after you have to reschedule a game from Hurricane Sandy. So who do you think I picked, Knicks or Nets?
Knicks going by what you're saying.
Right, going by what's saying. I tried. After making the switch... There's a Brooklyn, I'm going to be a Brooklyn Nets fan, but I won't hate the Nets. In the paper, I took the Knicks and the points. And we know what happened, right? So I took a little heat for that, but I say, you know, because I'm a Brooklyn Nets fan, I'm not going to bet them every time they play. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and to be fair, Jason Kidd, Amon Shepherd was out, and of course, Amari Stoudemire was out. It was a close game.
Anthony had that shot with Lopez had missed the second. He had two free throws. He hit the first one to tie it up with 24 seconds left, and he missed the second one. And then he actually had the rebound, but had the ball for the last 24 seconds, and they dribbled around, of course, and they gave it to Anthony. He's got to do his one-on-one thing, and He ended up taking shot a little too far out, kind of rushed it. In fact, the Nets got the rebound and ended up getting the shot off.
So. And Brook Lopez is playing great basketball. It looks like Orlando made a bad choice by not picking him up.
Yeah. They were going to take him, and the Nets were going to get Howard. Was that the deal?
That was the deal. That was definitely that was the deal. And you know, they kept wanting more, and what they lined up with Al Harrington.
Yeah. Orlando's going to be they're going to be in down the bottom of the heap. It seems like for maybe many years to come. The Magic.
No question. Before we go into the NFL, were you right on your pick? I don't remember. Did you pick Notre Dame?
What, last Saturday's game?
Correct.
No, we talked about it. Remember, I took Southern Cal in the 6.5 points in that game.
Right. Stewart for Brooklyn.
I thought, if you watch the game, when Southern Cal had a first and goal with about maybe 3 and change left in the game, and they first down didn't get in, second down didn't go anyplace, third down, now they're at the 1-yard line. I said, they got to kick the field goal to make it a 6-point game.
Right.
Because they had to score twice. And if they would have kicked the field goal, that would have made it a 6-4 game, and I had Southern Cal plus 6.5, so that would have been a winner. And I see I know the temptation was there because they're on the 1-yard line. They had like 4 shots from the 1, and they threw a pass, and it was incomplete. But, the coach should have realized he's got to score twice anyway. Normally, a coach would kick the field goal, even from the 1-yard line, because they know they got to score twice. If you don't get it on fourth down, you're dead. You kind of can't win. At least you kicked the field goal, you got a shot still. There was still 3 minutes left, and you're down. You're only down by 6 points. You get the ball back, and you get a touchdown, you can win the game. But,
That was
a tough loss. I'm yelling at the TV, kick the field goal. Even though, I'm a long-time Notre Dame fan. So,
Okay, let's get into the NFL, and I'm trying to see the hot games. So let's just start off with the Jets. It's 4-7 against the Cardinals. 4-7. I don't have the line for me.
The Jets are home. Let me pick your brain a little. The Jets are home. What do you think the spread is?
Oh, wow.
Jets in Arizona. They're both 4-7.
I would say Jets at 3.
It started at 3.5, and now it's 4.5. So the early money is coming in on the Jets.
Right.
You know what it is with the football fans? The Jets, two weeks ago they beat the Rams, but then they got clobbered. I don't know. But the early money in Vegas is coming down because when it goes from 3.5 to 4.5, that means a certain amount of money in the casinos are coming down to the Jets, so they move the line to try and get action on Arizona. I don't know if you know how that works.
Right.
They'll move the line up or down, whatever the situation may be, to try to get action on the other team. 2 teams, 4-7. I think I got to take the points on this one, King.
Okay.
I got to think I take the 4.5 with the Arizona Cardinals in this one. See what happens. How many? When are they? Are they ever going to play Tebow? What, a quarterback? What do you think?
I don't really care.
At one point, did they say, what if they lose again 4-8, then they lose again 4-9? Once they get eliminated, if you were the coach, would you just put in Tebow?
So they could still get in the playoffs, right?
I'd be shocked if they get in. What do they got? What has everybody got? 5 games left?
I don't think they're even in the hunt right now, but
yeah. So if they win 5 in a row, that means they'll be 9-7. But the problem is, most of the teams with the good record are in the AFC. So even for a wild card now, like Arizona's, the two wild card teams, Arizona's got 7 wins, and Pittsburgh and Cincinnati have 6. So 2 of them are going to get in, and the Jets are still. Even if they win 5 in a row, I don't think they're going to get in.
We'll see. Another high-profile game at 4:25 on the East, Channel 2. is the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Ravens. I believe that is what at Baltimore.
At Baltimore, right? They played 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago.
And the Steelers
had opened up as a 3.5-point favorite. Then they found out Roethlisberger wasn't going to play, so the Ravens became a 3.5-point favorite. And
okay.
I think the Ravens went off at 3, and they won by 3.
Wow.
It was either a Sunday night or Monday night game. So, and now just that went off at 3. So this game, the Ravens are 6.5 points.
Buccaneers.
Which kind of sense. If they were 3.5 in Pittsburgh, you'd just add another 3 on to make it 6.5. So that kind of makes sense.
Just to get that clear, who are you taking?
I think I might take the 6.5 with the Steelers turned the ball over 8 times last Sunday against the Browns. So I don't think they'll turn it over as many times. They're still going with the third-string quarterback, Tarley Batch. But 2 weeks ago. What's that?
Roethlisberger won't be ready yet.
He's not playing, and Leftwich is not playing. It looks like Charlie Batch again. Looks like the third stringer.
Vinny says, I think he needs a job.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right, Vinny. Yeah. Elmont Vinny.
Peyton Manning and the Denver Broncos take on Shiano and the Buccaneers.
That might be one of the best matchups of the day, right? The way the Bucs are playing. What do you think the spread in that one is, King?
Denver at home. Who's home?
Denver at home over Tampa Bay. Tampa Bay is hot.
Okay.
They lost a tough one last week, too.
That was Denver, though.
Right, Denver's hot, right. So, what do you think the spread is? There's a spread for every game.
8.
Close. Denver's 7 over Tampa Bay.
Okay.
I think the Bucs are hot, but the Broncos are even hotter. I would, now last week, I give you an example, like a team like Denver's hot, a lot of people like to bet the hot teams. But last week they were favored by 10 in Kansas City, and they only won by 8.
Right.
So Denver, there's a hot team, but they didn't cover for you. So,
right.
But that's why I call it gambling, But in this case, I'd Broncos 7. I think I'd go with Denver at home over Tampa Bay. Tampa Bay's tempting with the 7, though.
Okay, and I'll go with Denver. So we'll see what happens with that. And Peyton Manning is playing like the old Peyton Manning.
Yeah. They're getting their money's worth out there. Yeah. Remember, he almost went to Frisco. Remember, Frisco was.
They were trying to get him on the board.
And now Frisco's out to his quarterback. I don't know. Did you see him play against the Saints Sunday? You go, Colin, the kid from Nevada.
Right.
He was.
Right.
They put up. Frisco don't usually score that much. And they put up 31 points against New Orleans on the road. So I think this kid might be the starter for a long time for this team now, Frisco. I don't know if they're going to go back to Alex Smith.
Monday night, ESPN 5:30 on the West Coast will be the New York Giants at Washington Redskins. New York Giants coming in at 7-4, while the Redskins are at 5-6 and looking very much alive right now. What's your take on this game?
Well, what do you think the spread is in that game, King? Giants at Redskins. Who do you think is favorite?
Yikes. This is a scary one to guess. But
let me give you a hint. Remember they played early in the season when the Redskins scored with about 2 minutes left to go ahead?
Mm-hmm.
And then the Giants, the first play, he hits he hits Cruz for about 80 yards, 74 yards for a touchdown?
Yes, to Santana Moores.
Right. No, he hit Cruz.
Oh, okay.
Cruz. So that, remember, all of a sudden, because it looked like the Redskins were going to pull it out.
The first
play after the kickoff, he hits Cruz. I think it was 74 yards. So the Giants ended up winning by, I think they won by 3 or 4 points. And I think the Giants were favored by 7 points in that game. But that was many weeks ago.
So let me say that the Redskins will be favored by 7 points. That might be a lot, but let me throw it out there.
What do you think this spread is?
7 for the Redskins.
Redskins favored by 7? No, the Giants are favored.
Giants are favored?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, it's kind of like, if the Giants were 7 at home, You know, the rule of thumb is you get 3 points when you're playing at home, so that'd be a 6 point difference. So the Giants should have been one, but they made the Giants 2.5. Maybe because they look good, but the Redskins are coming on with that young Griffin kid. So
yeah.
Who are you taking that one, King?
I'm going to take the Giants.
Oh, the home dog on Monday night's tempting, you know. Very tempting. I think I might go with the Redskins in that one.
That's a tough one.
We got time to think about that one. Let's start till Monday night.
Yeah. Let's get this game out of the way. 3-8, both teams, the Browns and the Raiders.
Well, right now, they're not sure if the Brown quarterback's going to play Winden. So this is and the Raiders are playing terrible. Gave up 55 a couple of weeks ago. Lost again last week, and it shows you how bad they're playing. Because the Browns have lost like 13 games in a row on the road.
Wow.
So you figured, the Raiders would be favored, but the Browns are favored by 1 point.
Well, right. If anybody watches that, right.
Right. I mean, how can you bet a team that's lost 13 in a row on the road, going back to last year. And they're favored on the road. That so shows you how bad the other team is. I would go with Cleveland that one.
I would definitely.
Losing streaks come to an end. Winning streaks come to an end. I think their losing streak's going to come to an end.
Okay, we got the 3-8 Eagles with Andy Reid just about ready to lose his job. Taking on the 5-6 Cowboys with possibly Jason Garrett losing his job.
Right. That's the Sunday night game. Yeah. What do you think the spread in that game is, King? Dallas 5-6, Philly 3-8.
Is it in Dallas or is it in?
Dallas is at home. Dallas is at home.
Oh, Dallas is at home. That should easily be a touchdown favorite, I would think.
More than that, Cowboys 9 points.
9 points? Wow.
Cowboys are 9 points.
You know what? I'm going to take the Eagles with the 9.
I'm going to go the other way. I'm going to take Cowboys minus the 9.
Oh, okay. That's an interesting game. And we'll see how that holds up.
Not as interesting as the order would be. Take last night's Monday night game. You know, when the schedule came out, Carolina at Philly. You know, it's the two exciting quarterbacks and, Vic with Philly and Cam Newton, Carolina. You know, when the schedule comes out, he said, wow, that's going to be some game. I got to watch that game. It turned out to be a good game, but both teams are kind of out of the playoffs already.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean? When you see the schedule, you know, when it comes out, Philly at Dallas Sunday night, that's going to be a good game. Well, it might be a good game, but Philly's dead and Dallas is could be a slow death for them. They only have five wins.
Right.
And they're really happy when they lose.
Here's some teams that are not out of the playoffs. We got the Green Bay Packers against surprising Minnesota Vikings 6-5. Give me your.
Were you surprised how the Giants manhandled the Packers? Did you watch that game?
Yeah, I did call that win, but I didn't know that was going to be a blowout. I mean,
You called the Giants, right. I took Green Bay. I thought they were going to kind of get even for the playoff losses. Yeah.
A lot of people did.
The Packers just had that. They had that early 60-yard touchdown pass. And that was kind of like it for the whole day, for the whole night. I mean, they got a field goal. It's amazing. They couldn't ball. They were getting sacked. Fumbles, interception was amazing. I didn't think Green Bay could play like that, but they did.
So, with the Vikings and the Packers, where is that? Is that in Green Bay?
Right. So, Minnesota.
Oh, boy.
You got Green Bay at home at 7-4, and Minnesota right behind them at 6-5. So, what do you think the spread in that game is, King? Only a one-game lead. Only one game of difference in those two teams.
Right. Make that 7.
Even more, just like Dallas. Packers 9 over the Vikings.
It's a little too much, but I guess that's what Vegas feels, and that's what they do. And
I would go with Green Bay in that one.
Really?
I would go with Green Bay. Yeah. Sometimes a high. Sometimes if I just see a high number, I'll take the favorite.
Right.
It's just kind of like a rule of thumb for me. Yeah. Dallas minus nine, I'll take Dallas. Green Bay minus nine. You know, when you got two teams are fairly matched up, fairly even, and one of them's a 9-point spread, it kind of makes me think that it's going to be, the bookmaker might think that could be a blowout game. So I would go with GB in that one.
Absolutely. We got the 10-1 Texans taking on the Titans, who are 4-7.
Interesting game. So what do you think the spread would be with a team that's 10-1? How many points are they going to give King? 10-1 they are.
That's Matt Shore. And
the only time they lost to Green Bay when they played that game in Houston, too.
Oh, my.
In fact, Green Bay, I think, did a job. They might have beaten by like 14, 17 points.
And where was this game?
The game's in Tennessee, though.
Games in Tennessee. When was the last time the Titans won? Did they win their last game?
They had that Thanksgiving, the overtime game.
Right.
Oh, the Titans.
Right.
They lost at Jacksonville.
Right. Yeah.
Sunday.
That game,
that's how bad. Probably the worst team in the league. The only Kansas City has one loss. Kansas City's got one win. Jacksonville's got two wins. So
right.
They're in the rock bottom right there. And Tennessee lost to them. Jacksonville.
I didn't see it, but on the Thanksgiving game day, many people felt that they got robbed, Detroit. I don't know what happened.
I didn't see the play, but I saw a replay of it. Houston, what other guy? I don't know if it's running back or receiver on Houston. It looked like he got tackled. He kind of got, sometimes you get spin around, and sometimes your knee doesn't go down. You just get spin around. You kind of like just keep on running. So he got spun around. And he kept on running. He ran like 70 yards for a touchdown. But if you look on the replay, his knee definitely hit the ground. So,
wow. Okay, we got
now,
at 1 o'clock.
Okay, it's a long story.
On this Sunday on CBS will be the 8-3 Patriots against the 5-6 Dolphins.
Okay, we got Patriots and Dolphins. What do you think the spread on that one is, King?
Are we in Miami or are we in
Miami? Miami just beat Seattle. They just beat the good Seattle team the other day.
Are we in Miami or are we in New England?
In Miami, yeah, we're in Miami.
But
the Patriots on the road just beat the Jetsies by 30.
They ain't beat the Jets. They clobbered the Jets.
Yeah. I was at my brother's house eating dinner. I was watching a little of the game, and then we had the Thanksgiving Day dinner. By the time it was 0-0, by the time I got back to the TV after eating dinner, it was 35-0.
Oh, my God.
They scored all those points when I was down in my eating a little turkey.
Shocked. Yeah, as good as they played that day against them in Foxborough, remember that game where it came down to overtime? Tebow threw for over 300 yards. It was just as poorly they played that night on Christmas on primetime yet.
Right. Now, the Patriots gave the Jets 7 points on Thanksgiving Day. So how many are the Patriots going to give the Dolphins? Dolphins are a little bit better than Jets, right?
Yeah. I would say 6.
It's kind of a track. I kind of set you up there, little King.
Yeah, you did.
The Patriots are 7.5. Right?
Okay.
You figure they're going to be
more.
The Dolphins are better than the Jets. Right. But they, but I guess maybe because the Patriots won their last game by 30 points, they had to make it. Maybe that's why they had the bookmaker, the odds maker, had to make it more than seven points anyway. You know, but like I said,
right.
You can take either side. That's why they call it a gamble.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tough to figure out.
So, and you're going to take who?
I'll take the Patriots in that one. I'll go with the Patriots in that one.
Same here, the Patriots all the way. I don't know. I think you might see the Patriots right back in the Super Bowl.
That was my opening day prediction, King. Maybe we talked about it. Patriots over Green Bay.
I think
on opening day, way back in September, we have to make our Super Bowl prediction for the paper, and that was my Patriots over the Packers, so we'll see what happens, you know. Oh, I know
sure.
I gave your buddy Stewie another loss last week, too, right?
Yeah.
That was the Southern Cal game. I think I'm 0-2. Well, if he's smart, he's going the other way, which he might be doing. You know, in other words, if I tell him to take Southern Cal, he might have been Notre Dame, knowing him.
Right. Now, any other college game coming up that you want to pick one?
Yeah, we had we have some interesting what-ifs. In other words, you know that Notre Dame is going to play the winner of the Alabama-Georgia game?
Right.
And Alabama-Georgia is playing Saturday. Whoever that wins is going to play Notre Dame for the championship, because Notre Dame's one and Alabama or Georgia will be two. So America's Line had to come out with the projected, what they think the lines would be. I know you're not that big of a college guy, but if Notre Dame plays Alabama, Notre Dame is number one and Alabama's number two, what do you think America's Line has projected that spread to be? Care to take a guess?
We're just going to be
one against two.
One against two, so it should be close. Let's say 3.5.
Who do you think should be favored? The number one team, Notre Dame?
Yes, Notre Dame.
That would be the obvious thing. Shouldn't the number one team be favored over the number two team? But the number one team is just a ranking. For the odds maker at Vegas, they don't do the rankings. They go by, you know, they have power ratings. So if Notre Dame plays Alabama, America's Line projects the game. Alabama between 7.5 and 9-point favorite.
Wow. Totally unbelievable.
Right? Yeah.
We got a couple
and
more
you know,
games.
And you know a lot of people who take a Notre Dame with the 7.5, 9 points. And I know a lot of Irishmen are going to take those, you know, the number one team in the country getting, you know, 9 points possibly.
Yeah.
How can you not? I mean, still that's the way to go. You know, Alabama's going to play, still has to play Georgia on Saturday, and they're playing, and Georgia, they're playing at the game, is at the neutral site, but it happens to be at Atlanta, Georgia. So it's kind of like a home game from Georgia. But I still take, tell Stewie, take Alabama minus the 7.5 on Saturday.
Oh, okay.
Tell your buddy, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, two more games to tackle on the NFL. This will be a sleeper fest all the way. The 2-9 Jaguars against the 4-7 Bills. Let's just get that out over with.
I know it's tough to even talk about these ones. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll tell you the spread. Buffalo's favored by 6.
Right.
By 6 over the Jaguars. That's a tough. You know, like in the paper, I got to, you know, in Friday's paper, we pick every game. These are tough. That's a tough game. You know, sometimes you just got to take. It's time to take a game. Well, you're kind of guessing in every game, you know.
Right.
Carolina at Kansas City Chiefs. That's another game. That's another tough one to pick, you know. The Chiefs only won one game. But they covered against Denver last week, right?
Yes, they did.
No?
Yeah.
You don't care, you know. You don't care. Last week, you didn't care how many wins they get. They covered the spread. You made money, right?
That's how it works.
Right.
Andrew Luck and the 7-4 Colts. Take on the 4-7 Lions in what's left of the rest of the NFL.
Detroit is kind of dead. They're 4-7. That's another team. Even if they win every game, if they win out, they'll be 9-7. You know, it's I can't. So even if they win out, I don't think they're going to get in. So, but
so who's your pick?
I would go with Detroit in that one. Detroit
really?
4.5 over Detroit 4.5 over Indy, but I'd go with Detroit in that one.
You think?
But, not a strong play. You know, I got to pick it.
And do you think Andrew Luck is going to be the Rookie of the Year, or is it going to be RG3?
Wow, it's right now. It's really close because Griffin's been playing. Griffin's been coming on. Well, Luck. Indy beat Buffalo last week, but he didn't have great stats. And then, of course, 2 weeks ago, remember they had to go up to New England. Indy had to go up to New England, and remember New England put up 59 on him.
Yes,
I think they won. So he's had two bad games, and Griffin's coming on. It's still too tough to call. You know,
your
most better man win.
Yeah, right. You want to give our callers your most confident pick out of the games we called?
I will give you a call. It's a college game on Saturday.
Okay.
If it's a conference USA championship game Saturday, I think it's at 1:00.
Right.
Central Florida is playing at Tulsa. Now, even though it's a championship game and Tulsa's playing on their home field, I'm going to go with Central Florida.
Okay. With the points?
Central Florida, yeah. It's a pick'em game. So you just got to win. Right, right.
Oh, okay.
In the Conference USA, you know, it's two divisions. So Central Florida won, the East, and Tulsa won the West, and now they're playing each other for the – most of the conferences have championship games now. A lot of times, even if you go undefeated, you have to win your championship game, and there's a lot more pressure on coaches. You know, did you see the other day, like five college coaches got fired.
Yeah, well,
I think
it was
Monday,
that?
Colorado, Purdue. Now they fired the Auburn coach, who two years ago won the national championship. Remember when Cam Newton was a senior? Okay, I don't know
That's
if he was
right.
a senior. Remember Cam Newton took him to, what, 12-0?
Oh, he was amazing, yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
They fired that coach. Just won a championship 2 years ago, right? You used to be able to stay in college for years, 10, 15, 20 years. Now, no more.
And
after he wins the championship, how many colleges have won championships? Shouldn't he at least stick around for 10 years?
Yeah, at least.
Shouldn't they, all right, well, you know, we're going to stick with you for 10 years. You won a championship?
Yeah, and in the NFL, you don't stick around either. I mean,
colleges used to kind of like, you could almost have a career at, you know, maybe I'm getting old, back in the 60s and 70s. Say it's like a team that, like, say, Mississippi that was always so-so. That Mississippi coach, he stayed there 10, 15 years. And he can go like 2-8, you know, 3-9 every year. But now it's just different now. Now it's, you only get kind of like 2-3 years, and then you're gone.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they pop up someplace else, you know.
Yeah.
They're probably not going to be on the unemployment line too long. They'll pop up someplace else.
Right. Where do you see the Jets regime next year?
The Jets what?
Regime. Do you see the coach staying there? Do you see Tebow leaving? Do you see?
I think Johnson, Woody, the owner, Woody Johnson, likes
Rex
Ryan. And from what I heard, it was Johnson's idea to bring Tebow to New York. I wish he'd just tell everybody, you know, what his plans are for him. It's like, you know, nobody knows what he's going to do. What about the other big story? You know, Fireman Ed is not going to lead the cheer anymore at the Jet games?
Yeah.
I am going to miss him so much. I used to get a kick out of him.
Oh, my God. How many years is he there?
He's probably been doing, I remember going to Jet games in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, where they used to have different guys. Like, there wasn't one guy. Like, Fireman Ed, he controls that whole crowd of, like, 80,000. But back 60s, 70s, early 70s, there was, like, kind of like a guy for every section, and they kind of they'd get hand signals, and they all these guys would go down to like to you know the bottom of the steps, and they'd all kind of coordinate it, and they there might be 20 guys lifting, you know, directing, you know, 20 different sections, you know, for the JETS, jets. But somehow Fireman Ed, over the years, he just took over. He's the man. He had 80,000 people, like, at his fingertips. Okay, ready? J-E-T, jets. I got a kick out of it. I'll miss it. I'm sure somebody's going to step up. I mean, maybe they'll go back to the days where, you know, with his each section is going to have a guy, but the cheer will go away. The cheer will still be there.
Well, Mighty, we want to thank you for coming on the hotline tonight, and we will catch you, I believe, next week, either Monday or Tuesday, I'll let you know. Hope you had a happy
Thanksgiving. Just one thanks?
Oh, let me read. Right.
Give me a million like the other guy. I know the other guy's a big shot. Give me the other guy's, give me a million thanks. Just kidding, King.
Let me thank you a million for joining us tonight, as well as Richard Herman, defense attorney, CNN analyst, and we definitely had a great last two shows. Thank everybody involved, which is Mighty Quinn, who is practically a regular. I don't know if you saw the thing I put on Facebook where I thanked everybody, and I thanked you. So,
I came in, I got a little late tonight, so I'm going to check my email and my Facebook now. But always happy to come on your show, King. No problem.
Yeah, you do a great job, and the callers definitely write to me and tell me how great you are, and we're very honored to have you in our graph. But don't sell out to another radio station.
No, I don't. I do it all because you're a good guy,
right?
And I do it. We have fun, and there's never any money exchange. We just do it because we like to do it.
That's right. All right, Mighty. Thanks a million.
Okay, bye.
Okay, and we thank the Mighty Quinn, of course. Don't forget this Thursday, 7 o'clock on the East, 4 o'clock on the West, will be Pearl Jr. Also, William Wagner will be joining into the conversation on the first hour. So they definitely want to listen to that. We might try to have the Blue Meanie next week. We'll see. And Blackjack Brown will return. And we'll definitely have a lot of fun. Thanks to Richard Herman, Mighty Quinn, and everybody that's been a part of this show. And we will see you on Thursday at 7 o'clock East, 4 o'clock West. Goodbye, everybody.